Fans, it is Mother's Day weekend, and if you're thinking about mom or something special, Pave Fine Jewelry. I've said this for so many years. Michael Enlich is the premier jewelry designer in the country, and absolutely, that includes the Bay Area, too. If you want that special piece of jewelry that you'll have forever, that keepsake that mom will never, ever forget and will just brighten up the whole day, Pave Fine Jewelry is what you want. And during this tough time now, of course, you can make appointments, you could shop online and do things like that, but there is nobody better than Michael Enlich. And I've said this for so many years, and when you get to these special occasions, whether it's Father's Day or weddings, graduations, or all these special moments that we'll have for the rest of our lives, Pave, P-A-V-E, finejewelry.com makes it special. So, Michael Enlich, we love you, and thank you for all your support. All right, now, it is time to talk some serious baseball with Mark Simon. And you could follow him on Twitter at Mark A. Simon Says. He's part of Sports Info Solutions, a great podcast each week. And there's just pure baseball when you follow Mark on Twitter. Mark, how are you tonight?
I'm very good. How are you?
Very good. Another week. And how's the weather for you in Pennsylvania? I know there was snow in some parts of the country today.
Yeah, temperatures in the mid-30s at night and 40s during the day. This would not have been a good day for the Phillies to have played a home game, that's for sure. It was pretty gross.
All right. Well, we still have baseball to talk about, and, you know, we always find good topics to talk about with you. And as I tell people, I'll say it again, Mark A. Simon Says on Twitter, follow him. You can get the best baseball news all week long. I always look forward to his tweets. But this weekend, special Mother's Day tomorrow, and Dallas Braden, of course, pitched perfect game on Mother's Day and claimed this week he was hungover, sort of a minor Doc Ellis, not anywhere in that category. Look it up if you forgot who Doc Ellis was. And also, of course, on Friday, we had the anniversary of the Catfish Hunter perfect game on May 8th, 1968 at the Oakland Coliseum against the Minnesota Twins. So I said to myself, God, you know, Mark and I have never talked about the Braden game or the Catfish Hunter game, and I wonder what you can dig up with Sports Info Solutions as your guide.
Yeah, so the Dallas Braden hungover thing, that makes me laugh. Having met him and talked to him a pretty good number of times, it doesn't surprise me that he said that. Anyway, the thing about this game was that I think that the defense had a lot of work to do in it. He only got 5 missed swings the whole game, which I'm looking back at my ESPN notes when I was working there. It was the lowest total of missed swings in the last 9 no-hitters. So you aren't it's rare to get a no-hitter. It's rarer to get a no-hitter where you only get 5 missed swings. That's one of those things where you really need the defense to be very good behind you. And he threw strikes. He basically was in the strike zone the whole game. Most of his pitches were in the strike zone, a higher percentage, I think, than you would typically see. We have it at it's a 63%. So it's like if you throw 100 pitches, that's 63. Normally that number would probably be about 47, 48, 49. So he challenged hitters. He only went to 1-2-0 count and then got a line drive out on that one. The changeup was good. He got 9 outs with that. And he threw the changeup with 2 strikes to finish Rays hitters off. Did a very good job with that. The thing about Dallas that I think is interesting, he only averaged about 5.5 strikeouts per 9 innings. So I think he would have had a hard time surviving in today's game.
Mm. And I could be wrong, but didn't Gabe Kapler, I think he made the last out in the game.
He was last out. Yep, he did. He grounded out to shortstop and the Dallas Braden perfect game on Mother's Day, which certainly it's a decent statistical story because of the unlikelihood of a pitcher getting that many misses to throw a perfect game. But I think it's a better personality, human interest kind of story, the way that his life story unfolded.
Boy, absolutely. Very good. Excellent. You really put that together beautifully. What about Catfish Hunter? Could you find anything on that one?
So I just got done listening to the 9th inning of the game, which is available on YouTube. There isn't a lot that I can glean from it. I thought the interesting things were One, only 6,300 people are at the game, which I would have to think, other than like some of those ones that took place in the early part of the 20th century, that that's probably the fewest people to have attended a perfect game. 6,300 is kind of crazy, but I guess the A's weren't necessarily much to write home about at that point. 2-3-4 hitters were Carew, Killebrew, and Oliva. And that's a pretty impressive lineup to have to try and get through. And he struck out 11 in that game, including Killebrew three times. So that's solid. The last out was Rich Reese, and Rich Reese really battled him in that last at-bat. That's what I was listening to. It was like pitch after pitch, foul ball after foul ball. And it got to 3-2, and Hunter got strike three to end it. The punchline to, well, two things. One, he went 3-for-4 in the game with 3 RBIs. He was a very good hitter throughout his career. He had 226 as a pitcher, which is kind of like a Bumgarner-esque kind of hitting. The punchline is that he faced the Twins again 6 days later, and he gave up 8 runs.
Very good. You know, luckily, in my archives, and Raf does a great job of going back in these archives, I did an interview years ago, probably 20 years ago maybe, with Jim Pagliarone, who was the catcher for Catfish in that game.
Oh, wow.
And you're going to hear it a little bit during this show tonight. And one part that struck me, of course, the Rich Reese at bat, which was the most painful at the end. It went to 3-2. And Jim said that he thought he had him struck out and jumped up. And, you know, thinking he had strike three, and it was called a ball. And he said, oh, no, if the umpire takes it out on me on this one, I've cost Catfish's perfect game. So getting Rich Reese was a big deal to end it. Very good. You always come up with very interesting tidbits, especially on that Braden stuff, the fact that he didn't get a lot of swings and misses, and that's sort of the way he pitched, too. So that was very enjoyable. We had Korean baseball starting this week, and I don't know if you stay up or you get up early enough to watch it, but just interested in your take on Korean baseball and what you think about it.
Yeah, so I watched probably like 3-4 innings of each game, and I watched the re-airs of it when they re-aired it in the middle of the day. The home run bat flips are like, it feels more, this is weird because I don't particularly like the home run bat flip in the major leagues. Maybe that's just because it's not there, but it seems like in Korea that's a part of like every home run. So it kind of feels like it has a more natural place there. And they're entertaining, certainly. And just listening to them, to people talk about the fundamentals of baseball in Asia, and Adam Jones was talking about it in Japan on one of the broadcasts, and how the fundamentals are just drilled into you at a very strong level. The other thing that's kind of funny to me somewhat is that the guys from the United States that in the major leagues would be like the 24th, 25th, 26th guys are the guys that are like stars there. The pitcher for the Tigers, Warwick Sappold, who I'd barely heard of before, you know, a week ago, pitched a 2-hit shutout on opening day, which struck me as kind of crazy. Aaron Altair is considered like a big deal there. And I think you guys had the Giants had him for like a day. The Mets had him, and he was dreadful. So it's kind of interesting to see a world where players from the States are perceived differently. Now, admittedly, it's a different level of baseball. I would say I was very about it up until when I watched it, and then it was just nice to see a batter ground out to shortstop and just see the familiar movements of everything. That just made me kind of feel better as we wait here in all across the United States.
A lot of people think Korean baseball may be a step below Triple A, something in that category. So, all right, I'm glad you enjoyed it, and it gave you a little bit of a respite. And it's funny. We talked about old-timer games last week on the show, and I think old-timer games are fabulous. And the one thing I argued about was just for that millisecond, you can see the windup of Bob Feller or the swing of Joe DiMaggio or whatever it may be. And then, of course, you know, you're looking at someone who could be 65, 70 years old and, you know, lost that athletic ability. And what you said about the Korean baseball, for that millisecond, all of a sudden there's the shortstop The crow hop, the catch, the throw, and it is baseball. So that's what I could relate to as well. You know, it's funny. I did some research this week and looking back into the 1960s, and I happened to look at one of the All-Star games in 1965 and looked at the starting pitching and who followed for the National League in that particular game. And Marichal started, then Jim Maloney, then Don Drysdale, then Sandy Koufax, then Dick Farrell, who threw like 100. And then the ninth inning, to finish it off, Bob Gibson. And I said to myself, is that the best decade ever of National League Baseball?
So this was fun to look into, and I spent like 10, 15 minutes trying to figure out if I wanted to measure what you were talking about. And I thought that the most interesting tidbit that I got was that from 60 to 69, you had 15 Hall of Fame pitchers in the National League. And I have the names right in front of me, I think. That's like Koufax and Drysdale and Seaver and Marichal and Steve Carlton at the beginning of his career and Nolan Ryan at the very beginning of his career and Ferguson Jenkins at the very beginning of his career and Gibson. And it's a very, very good list. And then you go over to the American League, and there were only 8 Hall of Fame pitchers. So 15 in the National League, 8 in the American League. And so I looked at all the other decades, as many as I could before we got on the phone here. And there are other decades that have that many or more, but it's kind of cheating because they have like the bad versions of Maddox, Glavine, and Smoltz in the 1980s. Or the late versions for the 80s in the American League is Seaver and Jenkins and Negro and Sutton. The 60s, you kind of get the primes of careers of some guys, and then you get the beginnings that were good for other guys. And it's certainly very impressive to have 15 Hall of Famers in the decade. It may not be the most, but I think if you wanted to consider it the best, I don't know that I would object to you saying that.
Good. I like that. You gave me a good argument when I get into this with people. That's very good. The other one, I'd say Warren Spahn. I was thinking of your list. And even though we saw the end of his career with the Giants in 1965 or so, he threw a no-hitter in, I think, 60. I think he threw 2 no-hitters. One was against the Giants, and 2 days later, Mays hit his 4 home runs. Against the Braves, but Spahn is probably still in his prime, in the 60s.
Yeah, ages 39 to 44, and there aren't too many guys that you would call it that they were still in their prime at those ages. But for a little bit there, yes. But like that night, like Sutton debuted as a 21-year-old, Seaver debuted 22, Jenkins 22, Marichal was 22 in 1960 when he got going. There's a lot of really good there, definitely.
Oh, great. One very quick one before we say goodbye to Mark. A. Simon says on Twitter, and very briefly, Albert Pujols. And for some reason, his name came across my mind this week and the numbers he has put up. And I realize he's in the American League. He's a DH. He can't run. He's kind of clogging the base paths, and Trout is the big star and blah, blah, blah. But when it's all said and done, when that career is all said and done with Albert Pujols, do you put him? You can put him in the top 10 of anyone who ever played the game.
Yeah, the numbers overwhelm, and I think what will happen is like 20 years from now, like the children of 20 years from now will look at it and they'll be like, "Wow, like this guy is Hank Aaron, or not quite Hank Aaron, but close, or Willie Mays, or." Someone at the very top. Right now, we're in the middle of a depreciation of Albert Pujols because the back end of his career was not good. But the age 21 to age 32 is about as good as it's ever going to get for any player, just about ever. Now, he takes a little hit because he's a first baseman, but shoot, the guy's numbers are ridiculous. Every single year, the comps, the statistical comps for him on Baseball Reference are like the first 5 years of his career, DiMaggio. Then you get Frank Robinson, Miguel Cabrera. Then you get Hank Aaron, and then you get Frank Robinson. That's a pretty good place to land on for Albert. And yes, it's unfortunate that the end of his career does not does not do him any favors, but the beginning and the middle were really, 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 really good.
Very good. Yeah, I thought about him this week, and that was the take I had on it. Very good. I like the baseball reference list. It's always a pleasure to look at that and compare people. Mark, thank you so much for being on. Again, stay safe and stay healthy and enjoy the Mother's Day weekend, and we'll talk to you next weekend.
Yep, you got it.
All right, that is Mark A. Simon Says on Twitter. His name is Mark Simon and always has interesting, interesting insights into baseball. So more coming up, KMBR 680-1045, the sports leader.